Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
It is a piece of Long Island that has not been disturbed for over 100 years. So it's exactly as Long Island used to look. You know, the sandy trails and the pine trees and the beautiful clear water just bubbling out of the ground at 52 degrees all year long. You're not going to find a more beautiful place to me on Long Island.
That was Tom McCoy taking us to one of the special places on Long Island. This and my special co-host today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Before we get started here, if you get a chance, head over to Facebook, our Facebook group, wetflyswing.com/Facebook, and you can submit a question there, check in with the group, and help get that party rolling along. Tom McCoy is on the show today and brings his A game. We hear about why Tom decided to add another book into his collection of writings, why he is slowly closing down his website, and some cool history on the northeast part of the country.
We got a big episode here, guys. How are you doing today?
Very good.
Good to have both of you on here. This is a fun one. We've only done these co-hosted episodes. I think maybe only one. There may have been a couple of episodes, but this is a pretty awesome deal. I'm going to let Michael, he was a big part of setting this up. So I'm going to let, Michael, you take the lead on this today. But let's just start first. Let's introduce Tom. Maybe we can start with Tom and you can introduce who you are, first of all. And then we'll let Michael introduce himself. Then we'll jump into it.
One of the things, Dave, that makes this an interesting podcast is it's probably the first one you've done from Long Island, New York.
Oh, yeah.
I went through your list and I didn't see any Long Islanders there. So
that's true.
I think Michael and I are breaking some ice for you.
This is well, we do have a good northeast part of the country is actually a hot spot. But yeah, I'm not sure. I think you're right. I don't think we have it as specifically Long Island.
And Long Island's a special place. And you'll find that out as we go through this discussion, I'm sure. But I caught my first trout probably before I was 10 years old up in the Catskills with my father and been hooked ever since. Picked up fly fishing in my teens and really got into it in the very early 70s when here on Long Island some private clubs were made public. There used to be, the Gold Coast of Long Island is where the Vanderbilts and the Whitneys and the Paines and the Rockefellers and everybody else used to live. And they had their private fishing clubs. There were three of them on the island at least. And in the late 60s, they were sold to New York State. And they became state parks in the early 70s. And so that's when I really got into fishing the Connectquot that Michael and I were talking about earlier. And but I always went back to the Catskills. My first fishing was on Catskill Creek on the Hudson drainage, and my next was on the Beaverkill on the Delaware drainage. And I've been fishing up there ever since. And also have traveled to about 21 states that I fished in and five countries. So that's kind of who I am. I did it because I was a traveling business guy and I had a rod I could put in my bag.
There you go.
So everywhere I went, I tried to find some fish to catch.
There you go. That's perfect. And Michael, just give us a little intro because we've talked a little bit, but tell us about your connection here to TU and what you have going, and then to Tom.
Sure. I'm Michael Barger, and I'm the president of Artflick Trout Unlimited, located in Suffolk County, Long Island. That's the eastern part of Long Island. And the reason why I know Tom is because he, you know, during COVID, Tom did a great presentation for our chapter on the Connequot River, which is a home water, which Tom had just explained. And I think, Tom, you know, at the meeting on YouTube, you had over 1,000 hits on that. And yeah. I've also had the opportunity, Tom, to read three of your books and give one of your books away as a gift, and which is really fun. And you were so gracious to give away these books on Amazon during COVID that I took advantage of that and read those books. And I was very impressed with you and recommended you to Dave as a possible podcast. And he came back, and I thought he was joking. He said, why don't you co-host it with us? So that's been really fun. And here we are.
That's awesome.
That's great. That's great. Thanks for that, Michael.
You know what, you know, just to, you know, in your intro, I have some questions here for you, but to tell you the truth, you answered the first four questions without me even asking them. So you're a professional. I just couldn't even believe it. You answered every single one of them as you went. And so anyway, what I was going to do, this is the fifth question. When did you start to write about fly fishing and why?
Ah, that's a good one. Well, I was always a writer, a journalist, but personal, you know. It was just a way to blow off steam and say things I really wanted to say to people I couldn't say them to, you know. So I kind of honed my writing skills by just writing to myself. And then I have a good friend who recently passed, actually. His name was Manny, and he wanted to learn how to fly fish. He was basically a deer hunter kind of a guy and a big, you know, deep sea guy for fishing. And so I went down to the book review in Huntington, and they had a whole shelf full of how to fish books. And I went through all these books, and geez, first of all, they were all thick. They were all like textbooks. You know, they were dense texts that was difficult to get through. And Manny's an immigrant from Germany, so, you know, English is his second language. So I said, I got to find him a simple book to read with some pictures and that just has the basics in it, you know? And so I ended up writing it. And I gave him the book for, you know, his birthday in a loose leaf that I printed off my printer. And that was his beginning to fly fish. As I retired, which was in 2013, I said, you know, I got this book. I should try and do something with it. Up until that point, I put it in a PDF and I was giving it away for free to anybody that wanted it, as well as posting it on the LITU website. So anybody could open it up and read it. But then I found out about Amazon and their ability to self-publish. I had sent a book request to several publishers, you know, saying, hey, I got this great simple book on fly fishing. And they said, yeah, we got that. Thanks. so I didn't get any publishers, you know, calling me back. So I said, to hell with it. I'll publish it myself. And I did on Amazon. And it's sold so far about 5,000 copies. And the beautiful thing is it's on digital as well as print. So during COVID, I was able to do free promotion by giving it away for free, as you mentioned, to anybody who wanted to read it. And I forget how many. I think I got over 1,200 hits on that alone. People picking it up and reading it on the Kindle, you know. So that was my first book, and that's why I wrote it, and that's the beginning of the story, I guess.
That's fantastic. You know, I've noticed that you've written three books called Letters to Mac.
Yeah.
First off, who is Mac?
Well, in 1947, he and I were born about a month apart, and we lived about a block apart. And when all these baby boomers had to go to kindergarten, there weren't enough chairs, and everybody was alphabetized. So McCoy and McElhenney sat next to each other in the same seat, one chair. So that's how I met Mac. And we've been friends all these years, and I still I talk to him almost daily on text. He lives out in Carson City, Nevada now. But we stay in touch. But we've been lifelong friends, and you know, we played football together and lacrosse together, and did girls and cars and drinking and all the things you do as you go through life. And then he went to Vietnam, and I went to the Atlantic Fleet. And when we all got back together, we went fishing, and we still fish together once in a while. But now it's more me sending him stories about, hey, Tom, I was at the Connecticut and did this. I was up at the Beaverkill and did that. Over time, I wrote about 140 of those letters that I had kept. And so again, once I retired, I got 140 letters that are fishing stories, basically. And I brought it to a friend of mine who's a writer. And I said, you think I could make a book out of this? And she said, yeah, but you can't put 140 stories in one book. So I had to cull it down, and I ended up putting 20 stories in a book. And one book led to the other. They're in chronological order. So it's really a memoir, but it's me writing to Mac about where I went fishing and with who and what we did. And also, there's some non-fishing things in there. And as you know, there's salt as well as fresh. But that's how it came about, and that's who Mac is.
Wow. You know, as one of these things, you know, and I read all three of them. Yeah, about how many drainages and different rivers do you think you covered in your letters to Mac?
Oh, well, like I say, I fished in 21 states, and most of them are in there. But I mean, I fished all of New York, of course, all up to Maine, down to West Virginia, over to the Great Lakes, you know, all the steelhead and salmon of the Great Lakes, the Minnesota waters, because I had worked for a company out there, did bass and pike and muskie fishing there, and up into Ontario to Lake of the Woods, and back down into Montana and Wyoming and Idaho. In fact, I was just reading in the Trout magazine today about the Salmon River drainage, and they talk about the Locksaw River, which nobody ever talks about. That's an amazing river in just over the Bitterroot Mountains from Montana in Idaho. Then down into New Mexico and did the San Juan and a lot of rivers in Colorado, and spent time in California. I worked for a company in Sacramento for a while, so I got up into Tahoe and the Truckee, and up into the Deschutes and Yakima. I don't know. Did I leave any out?
Wow.
And then there's Tarpon.
Jeez. It's like, sounds like the whole country.
Yeah, it was. It pretty much is.
I think that, you know, I assume that your books are pretty much nonfiction, Tom. And you talk about shops, guides, fish, rivers, and most importantly, great pancake houses on almost every river. Yeah. What's your favorite breakfast spot and why?
Oh, geez. There's a spot when we were heading up to fish with Tim Linehan up in northwest Montana. And we were at the Rock Creek, and we're traveling up through Missoula. And we came to a town where you first hit the Clark's Fork up there before you kind of turn to go north. And I forget the name of the town, but they had the best huckleberry pancakes in all my travels. It's in one of the stories. I probably have the name in there.
This is the fun part, you know, when when Dave asked me to like come up with questions, I go, oh, that's going to be easy. I've got all three books on my Kindle and I do a lot of underlining. And so I went through the three volumes and I had about 50 notes to myself, and every one of them was about a pancake house.
I got a question for you, Michael. This is, I guess it's kind of for both of you, but for Michael, you know, you've read these books. I mean, what do you love about Tom's books? You know, what made you not stop at just one?
Well, you know, first of all, he does, you know, the books are nonfiction. So he talks a lot about a lot of guys that are in Art Flick, in the Long Island Fly Rodders, and the different drainages or spring creeks, not drainages, but spring creeks on Long Island and different places. You know, we're going to talk about the salt as well. And a lot of these people I either know or have met. But what I think is very, very special about Tom's books is that he has some very moving stories about loss of loved ones and the healing effects of fishing. And I was wondering, Tom, if you could comment on that.
Yeah. You're probably talking about, I had a fishing partner for 30 years named Jerry Greenhalgh. And Jerry and I were very close. He passed in 2009. And we fished constantly together. And when he left, when he moved on, I had to really adjust to fishing without him, which was really hard. And thank God for LITU and Art Flick and all the folks in Long Island. They kind of picked me up, and I started going with other people, you know. But, and they took me out to Montana with them, and they took me, you know, to the Catskills. And I started joining in on these group activities, and I wasn't a groupie person, you know, until then. But Jerry was the kind of guy, he was a physician, he was brilliant. He was fishing, trout fishing since the early 50s. And he just knew everything, you know. You know, I'd say, "You see that rise?" He says, yeah, put on a cripple. I said, "A cripple? What the hell's a cripple?" You know, and he'd show me and he'd teach me. And he's the one that really taught me how to fly fish, you know. When he left, I had to help his wife distribute his things. And he had a library of over 300 collectible fishing books. And I cataloged them all and put them out to some booksellers, and we moved them all, and we donated a lot to the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and such. But, you know, you get this when you go to the mountains. I catch a fish for them every time I'm there, and I catch a fish for other friends that have passed too. You know, a friend named Clark who I started with, and now I'll catch a fish for Manny. And it'll be in the spot where we were together and fished. And it just keeps everybody very close to me. I find it very, it's spiritual to me. I mean, fishing is not, you know, dragging a net across the bottom and see how many fish you can get. You know, it's being there and remembering all these people and these events that you had. I don't know if I answered your question, Michael, but I consider the mountains magic.
You did. And honestly, you know, the things that touch me the most is I know when reading your books, you know, you've lost some beloved pets. Mm. And having recently just lost a pet of mine this past summer, I know how deep that can be. And you frequently, you know, you go, "God, should I go fishing or shouldn't I?" And you always kind of choose to do the trip, you know, the day trip, you know, because you think, you know, like you say, I should be close, but I think this will help me if I go and do stuff like that. And that's really what made me ask you the question is, in so many ways, there's so many healing aspects and spiritual aspects to fly fishing. I think you do a really nice job in the books to kind of demonstrate that in a very real way. And that's why I asked the question. Let's talk about the salt for a second. You know, and you can talk about why fishing on Long Island is so special.
Mm. Well, I live on the salt. I live up on Eaton's Neck and been up here for 35, 36 years now. So I can see the salt, you know, from my living room window. And I walk down there every day and look for fish without a fishing rod. But I was a boater. I had a Grady White for many years, ever since 88. And so I became a pretty proficient saltwater fisherman in the Long Island tradition, in that, you know, in May you go fluking, and in the summer you catch porgies, and you look for the blues in August, and then the stripers in both spring and fall. And the thing I enjoyed about it is bringing people out. And in the end, it turned out I would be doing more guiding than I was fishing. Everybody else was catching the fish. But Long Island, when we came here, I was just about born here, but when we first came to Eaton's Neck, bluefish were so thick. I mean, they would get in the way. They were annoying. You know, you'd be trying to catch a bass and a damn bluefish would bite. Today, you'd be lucky to find a bluefish. I mean, it's the waters have been decimated. And much of that due to the menhaden problem, where they're catching them so they can make vitamins out of them down in the Carolinas. And that's the basic food for our bass and our blues. And but Long Island is such a special place. And so besides my own boat, I love to go out to Montauk. I have friends out there and have fly fished out there and from boat and shore, and caught, you know, some remarkable fish. I was lucky enough to hit what they call a Montauk blitz, where you had false albacore, bluefish, stripers, all hitting the surface at the same time. I mean, you had a hard time not catching a bird, because the birds were going so crazy over the fish. You'd cast and you'd end up catching a bird instead of a fish. But so Long Island can be like that. But of late, you know, we really have suffered from the things you read about in terms of our fishery being just decimated by overfishing.
Tom, we mentioned off air, I was just looking back through the back catalog. So Enrico Puglisi we had on a while back, he's kind of up in that neck of the woods, right?
Enrico, I don't think he lives on Long Island.
Not on Long Island. Yeah, I think we talked about stripers a little bit.
Angelo Paluzzi lives on Long Island. He's a guy you could probably interview.
Okay.
he's a great saltwater fly fisherman. And has written a number of books on it. But Enrico, we use his flies, that's for sure.
He uses flies, yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's got the brushes and all that stuff. What's so do you do more, are you kind of equal amounts, salt and freshwater, or a little more of one or the other?
You know, because I keep a journal, I know that, the answer to that question. And almost every year, it's a 50-50 split.
Yep.
Until I sold the boat. I sold the boat 2 years ago. And so now it's more like 80-20 freshwater, you know.
Okay. Why did you sell the boat?
Well, you know, for the same reason I'm closing down the website. You know, I'm 74 and things, life is slowing down. And when you have a boat, it's good to have a friend with a boat. Much better to have a friend with a boat than to have a boat, because there's a lot to it. It's a lot of expenses, a lot of maintenance. There's a lot to worry about. You know, it's like having a second home in the mountains that you only go to twice a year, and you worry about somebody stealing the plumbing out of it. You know, it's that kind of a thing. So, and I had it obviously for 30 something years and enjoyed the hell out of it. So, and my son has two boats, so
oh, there you
I can always get on a boat.
You're covered.
But, Yeah, but it was just time to, you know, start uncomplicating my life, and that's what the process I've been going through. And COVID, of course, you know, my wife and I have never spent this much time together in our lives.
How's that been going?
It's been terrific. I mean, we'll be married 53 years, and I was on the road most of them. So.
Oh, right. Yeah, so maybe we could kind of do a little check here. We're kind of, I think we're good almost midway, you know, or whatever through here. How are we looking there, Michael? Are we doing okay?
I think we're doing okay. As I'm listening to Tom, and he's talking about the mountains and the mountains being, a comfort to him. I noticed that in several of your stories, Tom, you talk about taking trips to the Adirondack, not only to fish, but to climb.
Yes, yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, the Adirondacks are a very special place. I had a cousin who lived in Keene. Mm-hmm. In fact, his whole family moved up there just before the 1980 Olympics, and they bought a motel. And he lived right on the east branch of the Au Sable. And so I got up to the Adirondacks quite a bit. And, you know, you get hooked. There's an organization called ADK, the Adirondack Mountain Club. And there's a whole cadre of people who try and climb all of the high peaks in New York. And Dave, just so you know, New York doesn't have very high mountains like the Rockies.
That's right.
4,000 feet's a lot for us.
Yeah.
So there's 49 peaks over 4,000 feet in New York. And people try and become, or 46 peaks. They try and become an Adirondack 46er. But I kind of always thought that's kind of like work, you know? It's like, oh man, I got to climb 46 mountains to be a 46er. I didn't want to do that. So I climbed all the small mountains. You know, everything under 4,000 feet was where I went. And you know, the beauty of it was no one was there. When you went to the big mountains, you were following a line up the mountain because everybody wanted to do it. But when you went to the small mountains, it was quiet and there were blueberries and there was, you know, birds. And so I would make a habit of climbing a different mountain every time I went up there and try and do a couple of peaks. And then I'd fish the very early morning and the very late evening. And hike during the day. It was wonderful, but my legs aren't up to that anymore. So I still belong to the ADK. I support them, and I love reading their magazine and thinking about maybe one day I'll go back and hike Baxter Peak, which is an easy one. The thing about climbing is, it doesn't make any sense. You know, you climb up this mountain, you get to the top. You look around, and then you got to go down. It's like, what's that about? I mean, you could look at a postcard and see the view, you know. but it's another what I call spiritual experience. I mean, you get up there. I remember being on top of Newmark Mountain, and the wind was blowing so hard that later I read that there were tornadoes in Vermont. Where would you experience something like that? You know, on top of a mountain with must have been a 60 knot wind. It was just amazing. And then you look out and you can see, I can see purple haze, you know, it reminds me of a song, right? But just the mountain on top of mountain, on top of mountain, on top of mountain, on top of mountain, off into the distance. It's just beautiful.
When you climb, Tom, do you carry a pack rod? Have you ever done that?
No, I try and concentrate on my climbing. It's unto itself, you know. Mm-hmm. I bring a Snickers bar, you know, but I don't plan on fishing. And in fact, where I go. It's hot, too high, really, for the fishing. Fishing is down lower, down in the marshes. But I certainly fish in the evening and in the morning on the Osable and on the both branches of the Osable, by the way. The East Branch is well overlooked. If you're going up that way, you should explore the East Branch for sure. You know, Dave, I wanted to mention steelhead.
I'm glad you did. That was actually a big, that was one of my topics I wanted to cover. So yeah, go for it.
Yeah. You know, when you first contact me, I'm saying, what the heck is this guy calling me for? I mean, he's talking about wet fly swinging for steelhead out west. And I haven't fished for steelhead out west, but you know, New York has two great lakes. We have Lake Ontario and we have Lake Erie. And they both are filled with steelhead, as well as salmon in Lake Ontario. And we have a salmon run every fall coming out of Ontario. And we also have a steelhead run that runs from, say, October till April, coming out of both lakes. And I've fished both of those. And in fact, if you go to my YouTube channel, which is Tom's Fishing Stories on YouTube, you'll see a couple of clips of our steelhead trips and the amazing fish that we pulled out of there. So, you know, people think, that's why I say New York is, and Long Island is an amazing place. I mean, we have spring creeks, we've got striped bass, we've got steelhead, we've got the Catskills, we've got the Adirondacks. And, you know, if you're a deer hunter, we've got some deer too.
There you go. There you go. No, I think it's, I love the, obviously the steelhead is a passion for me and everything, and we've expanded, but yeah, I always love hearing the different stories, because we've done a lot of Great Lakes steelhead episodes. We've only done a few of kind of the Northeast stuff. What do you, you know, if you had to describe it to somebody who hasn't fished out there, what would you say, you know, how would you describe it compared to, say, other types of steelheading?
Okay, well, there's a river that everybody goes to called the Salmon River, and it comes out of Ontario, and it is ridiculously overcrowded during the season, during the run, let's say from October to December, that run. I mean, you're literally elbow to elbow. You got to synchronize your casting. You know, it's like a ballet, but there's some fish. They do have a fly fishing only zone, which is upriver from Altmar, and it goes all the way up to the dam. It is a tailwater. And that's a little more peaceful, but not much. I mean, you get some spay guys in there, and you got to give them a little room, right?
Right.
So, yep. You know, but it's beautiful country. There's a lot of fish, but there's also a lot of people. But when you go to Western New York, when you go further out to the Lake Erie drainages, the Canada Way, the Catagaracas, now you have a chance of having a river. I've actually been on Canada Way by myself with steelhead, and that's unheard of. And other times, yeah, there's 20 people in sight, but there's enough water and enough fish to work. So I like the Lake Erie drainage fish better. But you don't get any salmon out of Erie because it's too shallow.
Oh, gotcha. But okay.
By the way, if a guy that whom I know and has written books on Great Lakes steelheading in New York is Rick Kushtish.
Oh, yeah, Rick.
And Jerry Kushtish. They're brothers. They both come from Buffalo. And Jerry is the guru. You know, he's our Obi-Wan Kenobi of fly fishing. He used to work, you know, for Sweetgrass Rods out there. And Rick stayed in New York and is a steelheader through and through. But their fly fishing for Great Lake Steelhead is a great book and has a sequel to it. You might want to get a hold of Rick and Jerry and get them on here too.
Yeah, I think I will. Maybe I'll hit you up if I can't connect with a wee Reese. I was just looking back at our back catalog way back at episode 12. We had Rob Snowwhite, who has a podcast, right? The Great Lakes. We covered the Salmon River, and
right.
It was a pretty funny story because he talked about that. He said how he was out there, and some guy had a boat that he. It was this really bizarre story that Rob. Do you guys know of Rob, the podcast he does?
I don't.
Yeah,
no. He's got. In fact, this is my first exposure to podcast as a medium.
Cool. How's it feeling for you? How's it feeling for you? Are you liking it or not?
I've listened to a few of Dave's shows. You know, the one on the I listened to the Orvis guy on his podcast. It was Phil
Monahan.
And I tapped into a few others, and you know, I can see the how interesting. You get sucked into this. The next thing you know, an hour's gone. You know.
Oh yeah. No, I mean that's the thing. It's the. The podcasting, I think I just enjoy talking, you know, and I mean, really, that's the bottom line is if you're just having a conversation and not really thinking of it as an interview, it's always better, you know, just kind of, you know, we'll clean it up a little bit in post-production and make it sound great. But no, I think, so you're feeling pretty good, Tom. You might want to do another one of these down the line?
Oh, sure. I like to talk. You know, it's fun to talk fishing.
Perfect.
Especially with Michael on board.
I know. Yeah. So what do we got, Michael? You want to you have a few more to take us out of here in the next 15 or 20 or so?
You know, it's interesting. I was on a podcast or not a podcast, an Instagram, I don't know, interview today, you know, Tom, and you're talking about, you know, you're around 74 years of age. And I was listening to a guy called Nimblewill Nomad who just set the record for hiking the Appalachian Trail at 83.
Nice.
and he just completed it. It's his third time. Plus he's done all the other trails and walked, you know, 5,000 miles on Route 66 or something. You know, he's an incredible character. You know, long flowing white beard. He's written a couple of books. And somebody goes, are you going to write a book about this, you know, your experience? He was on trail for 261 days. And he goes, I think I'm getting kind of old. And the person that was interviewing him said, you sound good to me. And I think you should do it. And don't let yourself, you know, be fooled. He said, I think I'm losing my vocabulary. She said, no way. And I would encourage you know, this whole shutting down, like I saw your website, you said you're shutting that down, you're selling your boat. And I'm thinking to myself, come on now, Tom, you know, you've got a lot more in you and a lot more to share. And I would encourage you to do more things and keep up the great work and the hiking and everything else. So don't let that be a theme. You know what I was going to ask, if you could talk a little bit about Southside and the Kinequat and the history there, because, you know, I recently went on a tour with friends of the Kinequat and I learned so much, and I know you know it, but others don't. Mm. I find that, you know, I find you as a historian to be very, very fascinating. So if you could talk about the Southside Sportsman's Club, that would be really cool.
Well, Dave, you have to give us another hour.
Yeah, go for it. No.
Well, the thing about the Southside Sportsman's Club is I can remember as a kid driving out on Sunrise Highway, going out to the Hamptons to visit a family we knew out there, and my father pointing to the gates of the Southside Sportsman's Club and telling me about the rich people that were able to go into that club and catch fish and shoot pheasants and, you know, everything else, and how lucky they were. And then we'd go by the Carmans, which at that time was owned by the Hards and was a private preserve too. You had to pay to play there. And he'd say the same thing, you know. And then I got to walk through those gates. I remember interviewing a guy who was an old TUer. And he was a friend of Gil Bergen's, who was the caretaker of the club. And he said he remembered the day when he stopped looking into the club and started looking out from the club. And it was ours. It belonged to the public. It belonged to all of us. And what a wonderful thing that was. It is a piece of Long Island that has not been disturbed for over 100 years. So it's exactly as Long Island used to look, you know, the sandy trails and the pine trees and the beautiful clear water just bubbling out of the ground at 52 degrees all year long. You know, it's stocked with fish, has its own hatchery, but that aside, you're not going to find a more beautiful place to me on Long Island than walking along that trail up to Bunce's Bridge, right? Right, Mike? Mm-hmm. It's just gorgeous. But the wealthy preserved that and kept it to themselves. But if they hadn't, it would all be soccer fields today. So I don't begrudge the wealthy that buy up these large tracks and keep them natural and use them for the right reasons, you know. I know, you know, out in Montana, there's huge tracks that are owned by the guy that owns, you know, what's his name, Ted, whatever it is.
Ted,
sooner or later, that's going to pass into public hands, and it'll be as it was, you know. So we need more of that preservation, especially in these crowded urban areas. I mean, we got millions of people living around the Connectquot, and you wouldn't know it, you know. So I don't begrudge it at all. But I do a presentation. In fact, it's up on my YouTube channel, and Michael was the host of that. He's the one who invited me to do it. So anybody who wants to know about the Connectquot and Long Island fishing, they can go onto that YouTube channel, Tom's Fishing Stories, and look up the talk on Connectquot. Oh, it goes for about an hour and 15 minutes.
Perfect. I'll put a link to that in the show notes and everything else we talk about today. That's perfect.
You mentioned a name, Gil Bergen.
Yeah.
And Dave, just for your information, I don't know if Gil Bergen, how many years was Gil Bergen at Connectquot? So
he was there 2 years before I was born. And he died there in 2018.
And Dave, just to give you a flavor of the Southside Sportsman's Club, I think, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, Gil Bergen, I think, was a dog trainer when he was like 16 or 17 years old or something at the park,
yeah,
and or at the club. And when they transferred the ownership to the state, the story goes is that Gil went with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, he oversaw the park till the day he died, right?
That's right.
And it's just a fascinating story. And anybody that's ever ridden a horse pretty much on Long Island or fished or hunted, you know, and you always forget that it was a hunting club too, but
yes,
but Gil like ran it, right? And if you didn't get off your beat by a certain time, you might have the eyes of Gil boring down on you going, you're late, leave. And when he ran it, Dave, you parked your car, there might be a line down a highway to get a beat assignment, and then you parked in a neoprene waders, you walked, you know, a mile and a half to the river. You walked.
Yeah.
And then you fished, and then you got out on time and you walked back to your car.
No kidding.
That's right. We used to put the waders in a backpack. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, or me, I'd be walking in neoprenes in August. So
these beach, you essentially, you go up there and you kind of get there early and sign up for whatever you want, first come, first serve sort of thing?
Correct.
Yes.
And you can spend a good 4 hours working a beat, you know, if you do it right. But the lucky thing is on Mondays, the park is closed. And Art Flick, for example, has a one Monday a month where they can fish the park, just them. And so they can wander from beat one to beat 30, you know, if they want, although that would take more than 4 hours. But that's the beautiful thing about the club activities at the park. Every Monday, there's a different club that has the park to themselves.
Do either of you guys know, the Art Flick story? Much. I mean, I'm assuming you both know a little bit about him since you're, you know, the Trout Unlimited and everything. But
yeah, I'm very familiar with Art. In fact, I have a couple books by him and of him. He was quite a character, actually.
I mean, that name is known. I mean, I think pretty much all around the country. What do you think, you know, brought him up to prominence?
Well, it's an interesting story. He was on West Kill up by the Schoharie River on the Hudson Drainage. He had an inn okay, like a little hotel, Sportsman's Inn. And you could go up there and you could fish the Schoharie or the Westkill, and or you could go hunting for grouse or quail or what have you. And a New York Times journalist, Mike, I forget his name now. I want to say Red Smith, but it might have been another one. Used to stay at Westkill and would write about Westkill and Art Flick. And that's how his name became prominent, through the New York Times.
There you go.
And the stories. And then he did a study. He was working with Preston Jennings, who was trying to write a book on trout flies, and did. And Art was collecting samples for Preston. And he collected so many samples, he said, you know, what am I giving these all to Preston for? So he ended up, he did give them to Preston, but then he wrote a book. And his book was The Guide to Catskill Flies, their hatch sequences and their colors and their sizes and their different forms. And Art Flick's guide is, to this day, I've got three copies on my shelf. You know, I still refer back to it. And then he got involved with Robert Volker, John Volker. He actually went out there and is in to visit Volker to fish. And he ended up, I don't think he got skunked, but it was pretty close after having traveled all the way from New York to Michigan, you know. So he got around, you know. And how he got to the Art Flick TU chapter, I think you guys adopted him, didn't you, Mike?
I don't know if we adopted him or named the chapter after him. I always thought that he was responsible. I want to say that he was a shoe salesman, right? You know, in his real life. And I want to say that he's also responsible for like a lot of the conservation movements up on the Beaverkill. Is that true?
Well,
I thought he created like no kill sections and stuff.
Yeah. He's on the Hudson drainage, you know, the Schoharie. They mm-hmm. they had a problem with bass coming up and eating all the trout. And so he had them build a very small dam that was enough that the bass couldn't get over it to separate mm-hmm. the bass that were down in the reservoirs from coming upstream and eating all the trout. So he was responsible for that. And I'm sure he was involved with all the other guys that you know, put together the no-kill sections and more importantly, the public access sections of all these mm-hmm. rivers in the Catskills, which at one time were all private.
That's great. And now a lot of them are public.
Almost all. You know, you have access to just about every stream. There are sections that are still private, but that are owned by clubs and leased by clubs and such. But you can fish both sides of them, you know? So you get a little benefit from those club stockings.
Michael, do you want to, I've got one more question that I was going to ask Tom. Do you have one as well? Do you want to give him two more and then we'll take it out of here?
I was going to ask about favorite fly patterns. Unless you were going to ask that, Dave.
No, mine was a little more on a tangent. So that's good. I like that.
Okay. What I was going to do, Tom, could you give us your favorite three best fly patterns for trout and for the salt?
Ah,
so you've got six flies.
I
I'm listening closely, by the way.
You know, I don't use a lot of different flies. I have a few flies that I use. I carry a very small pack. I don't have a vest. I mean, I have it, but I don't use it. And, the flies that are in there, I'm a dry fly fisherman. So although I have nymphs in there and I have streamers in there, my favorite streamer is a black-nosed dace. My favorite nymph is a gold rib hare's ear with a little pheasant tail off of it. And my favorite dry fly, there's three of them. It's the blue-wing olive. It's an Adams parachute, and it's the Joe Stack. And the Joe Stack is really a Fran Betters haystack that's been modified by my friend Joe Odierna. And in the salt, There's one fly. I use one fly. I use a green and white clouser. The clouser has two lead eyes, and it fishes like a jig. You know, the hook rides up so it doesn't snag on the bottom. And if you have a chartreuse and white clouser in with some different weight eyes on it and a sinking tip line, you can put that on in May, and you can take it off in November. It's a wonderful fly. And when I'm using plugs, they're all surface plugs, you know, pencil poppers and such. When I spin fish for the salt. But if I'm dry flying, it's going to have a green and white clouser on it.
Well, I was going to ask, there's a couple ways I guess I could frame this, but I was kind of thinking that let's just take it to the river. So you're on the river and, you know, you make it out there. You're kind of, we're questioning whether you're going to get there, but you get out there and then the fishing isn't that great. I'm curious what that other voice is saying in your head. It sounds like you've got this other voice there. Is that thing always talking to you?
Yeah, you know, the best thing about being on the river is I don't think about all the other things you have to think about. You know, you leave your work life behind, you leave your problems behind, and you get out on the river and you're concentrating on, okay, let's find where the fish are and let's talk to the fish. And if the fish aren't cooperating that day, I know they're there. See, I know they're there. You know, it's not like steelhead where they're running through and they're gone. I mean, these trout are there. They're just not cooperating today. So I sit down, I think about it, I look through my fly box, you know, I change a leader, you know, put a little tippet on, and I say, okay, I'm coming back. And I seldom get skunked, and I also seldom catch a lot of fish, mainly because I'm not interested in catching a lot of fish. You know, some guys will find a spot and they'll start popping fish. I'll move out of that spot. I'll give it up. I'll go to the next. I want another one. I want a different spot. Because I enjoy the challenge of playing hide and seek with the fish.
Which is why, and that's why you enjoy dry fly fishing mostly, just for the challenge?
Yes. 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 And the top, you know, it's kind of like the middle ground, right? The fish live underwater and we live on top of the water and we meet at the surface of the water. So that's our battleground. You know, I don't have to go to their living room and they don't have to come to mine. I often think of, although I understand the effectiveness of nymphing, the only thing wrong with nymphing is you catch too many fish.
That's right. Yeah, this Euro nymphing thing too, right? It's too easy. It's just too easy.
Well, I'm not going to say that. You know, you'd listen to George Daniels. I mean, he's brilliant. You know, but it's just. I remember in the 70s there was a campaign to try and get bait fishermen and spin casters to convert to fly fishing, and they had a little cartoon with a worm on it. You know, it's almost like the chicken saying, or the cow saying, yeah, go to Chick-fil-A, you know. It's like, I think the nymphing is bringing us back to the worm.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Well, Michael, anything else before we take it out of here?
No, I'm good. Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. And Tom, thanks for, you know, volunteering, you know. I think your books and your stories and your wisdom are something that everybody can learn from and enjoy.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you, David.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate you doing this today. And we'll definitely keep in touch with you. I'll put links to your email and Michael's email as well so people can connect with you. And if they want to pick up your books, it sounds like probably just heading to Amazon is the best place.
Amazon.com and, Tom McCoy, Letters to Mac, and How to Fly Fish for Trout, and How to Improve Your Fly Fishing and Catching.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for the time today, and looking forward, excited to keep in touch with you as we move forward.
Thanks, David.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all the links, and everything else we covered today, head over to wetflyswing.com/275. 275. A quick reminder, if you get a chance, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/Facebook. Head over there and that'll direct you right over to our Facebook group where you can ask a question, check in, submit a, if you want a guest, want to check in there, or just connect with me or the crew on Facebook. We have a big episode on Thursday where we dig into classic rods, reels, and fly fishing gear. Find out how you can easily find that old school classic or vintage setup. And we kind of just give you some good examples of what you can get into some really nice gear for actually a pretty reasonable price. So Ward breaks it all down on Thursday. You'll have a whole bunch of resources to help you get rolling. Just want to say thanks for stopping by the podcast today. Looking forward to catching up with you online or maybe on the stream.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.